Welcome to the Logger and Listings Podcast with JFK Properties. This podcast gives real estate investors, experts, and entrepreneurs an opportunity to share their stories over a casual beverage. Hosted by the founding members of JFK Properties, an investment company that specializes in commercial and residential real estate. So sit back, grab a drink, and listen to this real, insightful, and sometimes funny podcast on real estate investing and entrepreneurship.
Welcome to another episode of the Logger and Listings Podcast with JFK Properties. I'm your host, Kurt Warner. And in this week's episode, we have the pleasure of having Dan from Resilient REI. Dan, how are you doing today?
I am doing awesome. It is an honor to be here. Thank you so much for inviting me.
No, absolutely. Dan and I actually connected recently and had a quick chat, and I was very intrigued by his story, so I won't steal his thunder. And so, Dan, can you tell the audience a little bit about your background prior to getting into real estate?
Yeah. So, and thank you for saying that. So my background really came in the startup and technology space. In college, I was super into, there's this podcast that had just come out called Startup by Gimlet Media for any podcast heads. And it was all about starting a technology company in the podcast space. And I just became enthralled in that startup world. And so I ended up launching my own show, my own podcast, my junior year of college called The Founders Report. And it was just me running around the city of Chicago, grabbing people who were, you know, calling themselves entrepreneurs, some a little bit more polished than others, and basically putting a microphone in their face and doing interviews. And I did about 70 to 80 episodes of that.
Wow.
And I had no idea like how to monetize or anything, and posting videos and stuff on online to really help maximize the reach of the show. But I was able to get a couple sponsors, and I was able to learn a lot about media and about the startup world. But it came to a point in my senior year of college where I realized like, hey, I'm not going to be able to do this full time, and I don't want to live in my parents' basement for forever. So I used it to get as great of a job as possible. And so I ended up getting a entry-level sales position at a medical technology company in Chicago. I'm not going to say the name, and you'll kind of figure out why in a couple seconds here, but I came in and it was awesome. They had just raised $550 million. It was the second most amount of money any startup had raised in Chicago. Number one, kind of funny enough, is Groupon at $1 billion. And you came in, it was like working at Google or Facebook. Everybody was excited. There's ping pong tables, free lunches. We had three baristas on staff that would make you anything that you wanted. And I was just like, this is awesome. And there were sales guys that were making $200,000-$400,000 a year. And what ended up happening was, after about 9 months on the job, we got pulled into a conference room and we're told, hey, everybody, the Wall Street Journal is going to be coming out with some fake news, but don't worry, it's fake, and don't talk to any reporters. And one of the older sales guys, and I say older, he was probably like 33, raised his hand and said, well, what does a reporter look like? Does he have like a little thing in his hat? Like, does he have like a little notebook and pen? And what ended up happening over the next 2 months was just a nosedive for the company. Company that had all the, you know, momentum in the world, all the money in the world, to basically seeing lawyers running around, conference rooms being taken over with hushed conversations, people not showing up to work, people coming in the morning and just leaving, to the point where our sales manager ended up saying like, hey, we are told by the legal team to not make any sales calls because anything that we could say could be, there could be legal liability for that. And it left a really strong impression on me because I realized like, hey, job security is not real. Like I thought I had signed up for Facebook in year like three, right? Like I thought the sky was the limit. And all these people around me who thought the same thing, who were making great money, had beautiful houses, and all of a sudden they have to figure out like, hey, how do I get another $300,000 or $400,000 a year job? And with the stain of working for a fraudulent company on my resume. So that kind of kicked the whole real estate journey into gear, which has led me on a 5-year journey. I'm going into my sixth year now of getting into real estate and kind of building out a portfolio. So I know Kurt, I just threw a lot at you. I don't know if that makes sense or if you have got any questions about that.
It does make a lot of sense. So I've been there as well. You know, you think you have job security. Actually, my first job at a university, I was there for 2 months in a sales position for a newspaper and was fired. And, you know, right out of school, similar to you, you realize that job security is a myth. So what was it that drew you to real estate at that time? Because obviously, still being young, there were other options, going to work for another company right away, starting a side hustle, another business. But what was it about real estate that drew you in?
It's interesting that it was real estate that kind of drew me in, because I came from having that startup background. I thought like the startup life would be for me. But then having that podcast, I realized how many people were just working in a hamster wheel, you know, just working to get enough momentum to get that next raise, that next VC injection of cash so that they could feed their families. Mm-hmm. And I just was like, it's probably not for me. So maybe I'll go the corporate route, and the corporate route will, I'll make my wealth that way. And when that fell apart, it was like, okay, well, the startup lifestyle, that's not for me. The corporate life is maybe not for me. So I just started doing digging, right? Like, what's out there? What's possible? Mm-hmm. And as many people probably know, when you first start that, you just see a lot of people trying to sell courses, a lot of people talking, you know, about crypto. And crypto maybe 5 or 6 years ago is probably not the worst thing to get into, kind of in retrospect. Yeah, yeah. But anyway, what ended up really hitting me was real estate. And it's because there's multiple ways that you can make money in real estate. You know, there's cash flow, there's appreciation, there's loan pay down, there's all the tax benefits. But what really hooked me on real estate was I could buy something and then have other people pay down the debt. So long as I don't buy just an absolute dumpster fire of a deal, I'll probably be okay. And that's like the hook that got me with real estate.
What was your first deal like? Like, you talked about cash flow, you talked about equity pay down. Obviously, there's flipping, and there's so many strategies out there right now. So what was your first deal like?
Yeah, so my first deal, and if I could back up just a little bit, I then went on a 3-year journey to really figure out how to buy that first deal. I had to learn how to save money. I had to learn how to become a good salesperson and make money, right? And then I also had to learn the asset class of real estate. So what I ended up settling on was the city of Milwaukee. I'm based in Chicago. Chicago's a very expensive city. It doesn't have great landlord laws, high taxes. Mm-hmm. But there is a strong economic base here for sure. But I liked Milwaukee. Kind of funny enough, I was talking with a friend of mine, you know, years back, and I was like, yeah, I'm thinking about real estate. And he just said, oh, you should go to Milwaukee. And he doesn't invest in real estate. He knows nothing about real estate. And I said, why Milwaukee? And he said, well, you can buy houses for cheap up there. And I don't know why, but that like that stuck in the back of my head. And I was just like, well, there's cheap houses in Milwaukee, so maybe I should. So I, for whatever reason, Milwaukee became my default market. And it ended up serving me very well. And I've been able to buy a couple properties up there. So the first property that I bought was a $99,900 single family owned by a landlord. Wow. The rent was $1,200. Needed a little bit of rehab, but not by a whole lot. And this was in March of 2021. Which it kind of blows my mind. Yeah, it kind of blows my mind in retrospect. Like, I want to know why the landlord ended up selling it.
Like, was it listed at $99,000 or did you just negotiate it down?
It was listed at $99,000 and it was on the market for, I think, at least two weeks. And I was nervous because it's just like, this deal makes way too much sense. Like, why is he selling? But it ended up being great. The first tenant that I had, I inherited the tenant. They were fine. I mean, they never paid rent on time, but they always paid it. It was always like at least a week late. They ended up moving out, got a new tenant in who's been great, kept the rent the same at $1,200. So yeah, that was my first deal. And I checked on it and the Zillow estimate, and you know, take it with a grain of salt, values it at, I think, $134,000. So it's been good. It's been a good deal. And my whole objective with buying this first deal was don't buy a headache, just buy a base hit, because my wife, I was still convincing her about this whole real estate thing. And so I just did not want a nightmare in her to be like, you know, I didn't want her to turn on the asset class.
No, absolutely. And I think that's something that a lot of people starting out investing go through. If you have a spouse or partner, sometimes it's not you. Like, once you're convinced, you're in, you took time to learn about the asset class, figured out your strategy, but then convincing somebody else that, hey, this is a good idea, that can be a tough sell.
Yeah, for sure. And so that's why I just think it's really important for your first deal, just to make sure it's a base hit. You don't need to have a home run. Get on first base and then you'll be able to slowly work your way around the bases. And that's the beauty of real estate, right? It rewards patience.
So were there any lessons that you learned about the first deal? Like, you mentioned having that tenant, the first one that was always paying late. And I've gone through that as well when I was managing one of my mom's properties, when, you know, was kind of my first foray into real estate back when I was in university. So were there any other challenges that you faced and any lessons learned from that first deal?
I don't think that nothing went wrong. Everything was pretty smooth sailing after you get the property stabilized. What I did learn, and it's kind of held through with across my properties, and I don't have a large portfolio, like full disclosure, I've got four rental properties. But what I've learned is that when you underwrite conservatively, usually things aren't breaking every single month. And so you're, for the most part, most months you're not going to have vacancy. Most months you're not going to have repairs or CapEx. So the cash flow has just been incredible. So you might underwrite it at, you know, cash flow of $200 a month. But in reality, there are a bunch of months where it's $400 or $500 a month. So I guess on average, it'll even out because you will have vacancy, you will have repairs. But I was just kind of blown away by that because I was underwriting it like, this property is going to give me $200 a month in cash flow. But in reality, it's been more like $400 or $500.
Yeah, that is amazing. And I think that's something a lot of investors that are new, and I'm not sure if you run into investors that are new as well that do this, where they are very aggressive on their underwriting. And one thing that I always tell them, you're better off being conservative and being able to acquire property at a price where worst case scenario happens, you should still be able to cash flow that property. So going through vacancy and repairs and, you know, some CapEx as well. So did you find it challenging to invest outside of your market? Because that's another thing that I hear from people looking, especially for their first deal, is they want to be as close to home as possible, but you went way outside of what most people would consider their comfort zone. So what was that like?
Well, Milwaukee to Chicago is not like, I know a guy who invests from Hawaii and invests in Pittsburgh. Mm-hmm. And that to me is a whole different story than Chicago to Milwaukee. So I think that there is a little bit of a scale to it, whether you can just get in a car and drive. For me, it's about an hour and a half compared to driving an hour and a half to an airport to then sit on a plane to go view your properties. But for me, it's been really good. And the reason why it's been really good is because I've been able to get myself plugged in with a rockstar property manager. Mm-hmm. And this is one of the benefits for investing out of state. It could also be, for sure, it could also be a risk working with a property manager because there's plenty of bad property managers out there. But the one that I work with has been investing in the market for 30 plus years. She's got a sizable portfolio in the market, and she's also my agent. So when she's able to walk properties, she's able to put her agent hat on and say, this is how we can get this deal. And then she can put her property management hat on and say, this is the type of tenants and the rent that we would get. And from a tenant perspective, they would like this or they wouldn't like this. This is some of the stuff that we need to change. And then she also has a wealth of connections on the contractor side. So she can even put her general contractor hat on and say, this is probably what it'll cost to get this place repaired. So as a newbie, when I was first getting into it, having that was invaluable. Mm-hmm. And I think that even if you're going to invest locally, you should try and talk with property managers. You should try and build out those connections because a good property manager is kind of like a spider in the web, right? They've got all these connections that they've built out over years, especially if they're a really good property manager. And when you work with one of them, you automatically get access to that entire network. So if you're going to invest out of state, I think that's one of the benefits. It is mm-hmm. also a risk factor. If you just go with the first property manager that you meet with, it could certainly bite you. But for me, it's been a huge blessing.
So did you make trips up there initially, especially for the first deal, or did you just rely on your property manager to kind of feed you the information?
So I've made a couple trips up to Milwaukee. I've never, for full disclosure, I've never walked in any of my properties. I relied on video from my property manager. And so that's the relationship and the trust that we've been able to build over time. But I think what was the most meaningful, I've made a couple trips up there, but the most meaningful trip for me was going up and meeting with my property manager in her office, which was a bungalow in suburbia that she just got a great deal on 20 years ago. And she's just like, hey, I'll just have it as my office, you know, for the tax write-offs and stuff. I don't need a big office building. And we sat down there and we went through my calculator, my numbers. She said, I would change this. I would tweak that. This is what we see in art in this market compared to what you might be reading online on bigger pockets. Mm-hmm. And then she said, these are the specific areas that you need to be investing in because based on your budget, based on what you're looking to do, your yield, all that. And what I've then done in the future is I actually mailed her like an old school, like roadmap, like one that you get at a gas station if you're going on a road trip and have her circle. These are the blocks that you want to be on. This is the neighborhoods that you want to be on. These are the areas you want to avoid, and basically take all of her knowledge and put it on this map. And then I took that map and put it onto Redfin and then had notifications. So anytime something comes up for sale on Redfin within those areas, I get notified immediately and then I can get on the phone with her. But the other thing that was so important with that meeting was just understanding what type of businesswoman she is. And I think that's really important when you're looking at property managers, is that you want to be working with a good business person. And what I mean by that is after we did the whole meeting, like an hour, hour and a half meeting, she gave us a tour of her facilities. She showed the big pegboard with all the keys for all the properties that she works with. Mm-hmm. So organized. She's very organized. And then she's like, do you want to see something kind of crazy? And we went into the basement of this house and it was just filled with building materials. She had gallons and gallons of paint, all this different type of flooring. Well, all the same flooring, but a whole bunch of different, you know, boxes of laminate flooring. Mm-hmm. And then $8,000 worth of smoke detectors and dehumidifiers and all this stuff. And so she says, you know, when we get a new property, we use the same paint, we use the same flooring, we have all these smoke detectors because I got a great deal on them. Basements have to have a dehumidifier. So that's what I'm talking about with dealing with a good business person, somebody who wants to take care of these properties, but at the same time wants to do it in an economical way.
I think that is a very good point, because I work with property managers well and met them the first time we went up to the market that we invest in Northern Ontario, and understanding, you know, how she started the business, that she invested as well, how she was building out her team and scaling it. And I think a lot of people take that relationship with a property manager for granted, especially if you're investing outside of your own area. And sometimes even if you are investing in your area, it helps to have a property manager, because we're investing in real estate not to get another job. We don't want those calls at 11 at night that, you know, a faucet is, you know, not working properly, or their toilet. Like, we want those calls to go to people that have a business, that are ready and prepared to handle them, know what they're doing, and then report to us after. So as you're kind of going through your journey, you said that you're starting to build up your portfolio. Have you stuck with that same strategy of looking for kind of the single family home where the numbers work, where it does cash flow? Or have you looked at kind of getting into different strategies at this point?
I really like single family. And I will say that I've shifted a little bit. And what I've discovered within my market is that there are a number of these developments, and they've got townhouses, essentially, like townhouse condos. They're kind of like a little bit of a weird asset class, mm-hmm. where it's a basement, a first floor and a second floor, but you're sharing two walls with people in the development. And I've discovered that these assets are mispriced, because they live like a single family. They don't live like a multifamily, because you don't have people living above you. Nobody loves people living above you and hearing people's footsteps. Mm-hmm. But people are more flexible when you're just sharing a wall side by side. So they actually rent at the same price as a single family. Mm-hmm. But from a acquisition standpoint, investors don't like it, because investors are scared of HOAs. And yes, for a good reason. HOAs are not great. So you have to be careful, for sure. So investors don't really love them. And homeowners, they also don't really love them, because if you're going to buy something, you might as well just buy a single family. So these units are relatively mispriced and give really strong yield. There is that risk factor of the HOAs. So that's mm-hmm. actually why I'm beginning to shift away from them. But my next couple acquisitions have been these townhouse condos, just townhouse, I think that's what they're called anyway, because they've been great for yield. They've been great. People really like it. It's the ability to add an extra bedroom. People get their own parking spot, typically no garage. So that is a little bit of a turnoff. But they're priced well, and the rent is the same as a single family. I have started to shift away. I want to get more single families just to diversify a little bit.
Yeah.
But that's what I've done after that first deal.
So what's the difference in price? Like, you know, if you took the single family home, so your first deal at 99 versus, let's say, a townhouse condominium, roughly the same size, what would be the difference in price there?
Well, I'd like to be buying single family between 80 to 120,000. And these townhouse condos are going anywhere between 40 and 60.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. That's now, there is an there's an HOA payment on top of it. So it's not as good as you think of it is, but it does. The numbers are really good.
That's awesome. So what do you see happening in the real estate market moving it? Because 2022 was an interesting year. Certainly was in Canada. And when we, you know, spoke initially, same thing that you're seeing in there with interest rates, housing prices starting to stabilize and actually turn down in some markets. So what do you see happening in 2023? And how is that going to impact your strategy moving forward?
I should say that I am not an economist. I have been doing this for 5 years investing. So I'll be going to my third year of actually owning property. So everything I say is with a grain of salt. But what I do with Resilient REI is I spend a lot of time networking and speaking with other investors, whether it's for my own podcast or for my newsletter. So I feel like I've got a pretty good gauge on the market. Mm-hmm. And a good friend of mine, Jordan Santiago, who is a wholesaler out of New York, said it really well. He said that sellers think it's 2021, buyers think that's 2009, which I think is a very good way of putting it. Because, you know, if you're a seller, you still think that you've got that wonderful home, housing prices, you've got all this equity, I'll be able to get a great deal. So and then from the the buyer side, right? You're looking for a deal. You're looking at these interest rates, especially if you're an investor and you're trying to buy on yield. Like, a lot of these deals just don't make sense. So I think that there's going to be, houses are going to be sitting, sellers are going to have to become educated, and it's going to be a painful process. I also think that a lot of people aren't going to be going on the market. So there's going to be a huge lack of inventory. And from the investor side, what I am the most concerned with is the short-term rental side of things. And I do a whole article on my newsletter on short-term rentals. I've got people who are professional short-term rental hosts. I personally do not own any. So again, grain of salt. But from just observations, there have been a lot of really bad deals that have been done. I think it's about 50% of all Airbnbs have come online since 2019. It's hard to make a deal not work when you're able to get $200 or $300 a night and then another, you know, couple hundred bucks in bogus cleaning and service fees. Mm-hmm. So I think a lot of bad deals were done. And I think that the cream of the cream, the top 10% of Airbnbs are going to be fine. Maybe the next 10 or 20% are going to be okay. And I think that there's going to be a lot of people who are going to be in some trouble. So I think that there's going to be opportunity on the short-term rental side, especially if we go into, you know, depending on how good of a how bad of a recession we're going to have.
Well, you say good from an investor standpoint, because that's where a lot of millionaires are made, is, you know, during recession when other people are scared, that's when opportunities present themselves. And it's interesting that you say that about short-term rental. I was listening to Robert Kiyosaki's podcast that I think came out a couple of days ago, and they were talking about short-term rental, and had a friend of his that purchased a condo. I can't remember the market, but he was referencing that in Hawaii, with all of the, you know, major hotels, that they've actually pushed out short-term rental. So people that had bought properties for the purpose of short-term rental, and I don't know which island it was on, but now they can't rent them out legally as short-term rental. So now they're stuck with something that you thought was an asset that would cash flow, where if your long-term rental rates don't justify the payments, then you're in a negative cash flow position. And with the market where it's at, you bought it in, let's say, you know, 2021, and now prices are starting to come down, you haven't built up a ton of equity to even sell it and make a profit. So, you know, I think there is a trend here where you have to be, as an investor, you have to be more diligent. You have to have multiple exit strategies. I don't think you can go in thinking, hey, I'm just going to, you know, especially those people that are buying, renovating, renting and refinancing, you know, that strategy has completely changed with this interest rate environment. So tell us more actually about your podcast, your show. Like, I had a chance to listen to a couple episodes and it's awesome. And if you could share with our listeners more about the show, so hopefully they can start listening to you as well.
Well, I appreciate you saying that. It's doing the podcast and doing everything I'm doing with Resilient REI. It oftentimes feels like I've got a second full-time job, but it's worth it. It's a lot of fun. So my day job is in media, and particularly on the B2B media perspective. So it's creating content for business owners. That's my day job. And so I'm on the advertising, the sales side of that. And what I realized with the real estate world is that there's a lot of people out there who are creating content, but it's like influencer content, right? People are trying to sell to you their course, people talking about Airbnb arbitrage, you know, sitting shirtless on top of a Lamborghini or whatever. And I was just like, I think I could do a better job. So I launched Resilient REI a year ago with a Twitter account. And then I added on a newsletter, and then obviously a podcast in August. And the whole idea is just to try and find people who are crushing it in real estate and who want to give back, who want to educate, like you're doing with the show, right? You're talking to people who are pros, who are really killing it, and helping them spread that knowledge to other individuals. And so that's what I'm trying to do with Resilient REI. I have a twice weekly newsletter on Tuesdays. I bring on different pros who are focused on very specific segments, BRRRR, short-term rental, landlording, and wholesaling. And then I have a featured investor that we do a whole profile on every Friday. Mm-hmm. And then we do a Twitter Spaces every single Tuesday at 7 p.m. Central. And then every single Monday, we do a conversation with somebody in the real estate world. I'll try to be very focused on like what they're doing, specific strategies, stories, trying to have it be an engaging conversation.
Awesome. So where can people find Resilient REI? On Twitter, website?
Twitter, Instagram, Resilience REI. The podcast is called Resilient Real Estate Investing on Apple and Spotify. I'm trying to have it as easily accessible as possible for everybody.
Well, we'll make sure that we add those links to the podcast description so people can, you know, follow you as well and listen and, you know, again, continue getting educated and continue to learn. And one final question for you, Dan. What advice would you give to someone who wants to get into real estate in 2023 for the first time?
What I would suggest for someone who wants to get into real estate in 2023 is to be consistent. And I am a huge fan of the late Earl Nightingale, and he wrote that you become what you think about. And I think that that's really important, but I think that you need to add one more step to it. You become what you think about, and you become what you consistently work towards. If you want to get into real estate, every single day, you need to be listening to a podcast, watching something on YouTube, reading a book, looking at your market, running numbers. It doesn't need to be hours and hours and hours a day. It could be 20 minutes. But every single day, if you're serious about this, you need to be putting in the work. You need to be educating. You need to be learning and listening to great podcasts like this one. So that's my tip. Every single day, you need to be pushing that ball one step further.
Awesome. That's great advice, Dan. And again, it's a pleasure having you on the Logger and Listings podcast. Looking forward to getting to know more about you. Again, it's always amazing to connect with people that are in this business, especially those that are, you know, producing content to help other investors and keep everybody educated.
Hey, thank you so much for the opportunity, Kurt.
All right. And to everybody that's listening, again, thank you for tuning in to Logger and Listing. Cheers.
If you've enjoyed listening to the Logger and Listings podcast, leave a like or a comment. Not only will we appreciate it, but it will also help this podcast grow organically and help other investors and entrepreneurs grow their businesses and have fun along the way.